Diffusing the population bomb.
One of the things that we can do the fastest that would actually have the most significant effect on the human impact on the planet would be to start to manage the numbers of us who are on the planet. It's something that is actually turns out to be culturally acceptable throughout much of the world, which I had to travel through much of the world to discover for this book. But ultimately, you know, to me, this is a book whose time has really come.
That's journalist Alan Weissman. We spend the hour with him talking about his important and riveting new book, Countdown. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The population bomb is already exploding, and it underlies much of the conflict we see in the world today, from Israel and Palestine to Pakistan to China's increasing aggression in the Pacific. If current trends continue, by the end of this century, the Earth's population will be somewhere around 11 billion people. My guest this hour, journalist Alan Weissman, says that means we're going to have to produce more food in the next 50 years than has been consumed in all of human history. But here's the thing. Scientists estimate our planet's carrying capacity is only about 2 billion people. And arable land, water, fertilizer, and topsoil are all shrinking. Global warming is cutting food production further. Each degree of warming is estimated to cut it by 10%, and we're headed straight for 4 to 5 degrees of global temperature rise. And just to close the circle, overpopulation is a major, perhaps the major, contributor to climate change. In his terrific new book, Countdown, Alan Weissman says either we volunteer to bring our global birth rate down, or nature will do it much more painfully for us. That may sound hard to do, but Weissman lays out a convincing argument that it isn't. In fact, could family planning be, as the subtitle of Countdown asks, our last best hope for a future on Earth? Weissman traveled all over the globe to find the answer, and what he discovered might surprise you. Religious extremism is not always the barrier we think, and family planning is popular, especially when paired with cheap contraception and education of girls. Weissman says we know how to do this. It's not expensive, and our survival depends on it. We last spoke with Alan Weissman about his New York Times bestseller, The World Without Us. He's also author of 3 other books and has written for Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, Atlantic Monthly, Discover, and Orion, among others. Alan Weissman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very much.
The last time we spoke, we talked about your book, The World Without Us, a wonderful thought experiment about what would happen if we suddenly, all human beings, just vanished from the planet. And at the very end of that book, you mention the issue of overpopulation. And I questioned you at that time. I said, this seems to be, you know, in some ways, the most important question that you've asked. How come you didn't do more about it? And at that time, you said that you felt people weren't quite ready to hear the message that you now do bring in this wonderful book, Countdown. Do you think people are more ready now to hear that we need to limit our population?
Well, I think in the 6 years since The World Without Us came out, the whole world has had an education. We're starting to see visible signs of how the ecosystem that supports human life is bursting at the seams. And there are very few people who aren't taking climate change, for example, seriously anymore. And people are going beyond that. They're beginning to realize that the same forces that are changing the climate are changing literally the chemistry of the seas from which we all spring, including all of our food chain. We're talking about serious business now. And I decided to write this book for a number of reasons, but a big one is that one of the things that we can do the fastest that would actually have the most significant effect on the human impact on the planet would be to start to manage the numbers of us who are on the planet. It's something that is actually turns out to be culturally acceptable throughout much of the world, which I had to travel through much of the world to discover for this book. But ultimately, you know, to me, this is a book whose time has really come.
Yeah, and hopefully it's one that we can take the lesson from. I mean, I'm surprised that you say that you found that it was a point that was acceptable in much of the world, because I think most people would think that, you know, with all the fights over abortion in this country, for example, I mean, there's even, the right wing is trying to control the access to contraception, much less abortion. There are places in the world where the birth rate is extremely high, and you visited them. You went to Israel and Palestine first, some of the highest birth rates in the world in those two countries. Talk about what drives both population expansion and what drives its control in our globe at this time.
Absolutely. Let's talk about that, but I want to make sure that we leave some time to get back to your original question about cultural acceptance of the opposite of uncontrolled population growth. What drives population growth? Two things, really. More people are born than die, and people live longer. Now, to understand that, we have to realize that through 99% of human history, the human population grew very, very little on this planet. I mean, it barely crept up from a flat line, and that's because people were dying about as fast as people were being born. I mean, it must have been incredibly painful for our ancestors, but until about 200 years ago, most babies didn't make it to their fifth birthday, and human life expectancy was about 40 years. Now, starting, I think, in 1798 with a vaccine for smallpox, we started turning the corner on mortality. We invented more vaccines, pasteurization of milk, an understanding of antiseptics and of cleanliness in hospitals, and we brought infant mortality way down, so a lot more babies were surviving and people were living longer. And then the second thing, even bigger than modern medical technology, in the 20th century, we did two things that enormously increased the amount of food on this planet. First, probably the most influential human invention of any was something called the Haber-Bosch process. That's not a familiar name to people for the most important invention, but what it was a way to pull nitrogen out of the air and chemically apply it to soils. Before that, the amount of plant life on the planet was literally limited to the nitrogen contribution of a few plants who host bacteria on their roots that can naturally fix nitrogen. But now we could do it. And then that, you know, that took place right before World War I, got commercialized in the 1930s, and about three decades later came what is known as the Green Revolution. That was a way of enhancing the yields of grains, wheat and rice, and also to a certain extent corn, by being able to grow many more grain kernels per plant than ever before through some very deft genetic selection. As a result, in the 1970s, some famines that were widely predicted, and most famously by the authors of The Population Bomb, Paul and Ann Ehrlich, who were echoing the predictions of population growth always outstripping food production that Robert Malthus famously made back before there were even a billion people on the planet. They predicted that the way population was growing, you know, as a result of the medical and agricultural technology, our population actually doubled and then doubled again in the 20th century. But by the 70s, they didn't expect that to happen. However, the Green Revolution is widely touted as having refuted Malthus and the Ehrlichs, because the places where it was tried out first, India and Pakistan, didn't have those famines. But let's look at those countries today, which I did. I went, and there were two of the 21 countries I visited for this book. India is about to surpass China as the most populous nation on earth, and that's simply because people who didn't die of famine lived to beget more people, children, who then also grew up to beget more people. Pakistan's really one of the scariest places I've ever worked in. 60-some countries I worked in as a journalist. There are 185 million people right now in Pakistan. And this is a country that's about the size of Texas, which has 26 million people. And by the middle of the century, if it keeps growing the way it's growing, it's going to have nearly 400 million people. Now, that's a lot more than the entire United States has, and it'll still be the size of Texas. So it's growing out of control, and the country's filled with youth who the economy cannot employ because there are just too many of them, so they get frustrated, they get angry, and they become what we oftentimes call terrorists in this country. And Pakistan's also a nuclear power. I mean, this is a country, when I was there, there was just mayhem in the streets every single day. To the people that I went to interview, who were ecologists who were trying to save mangrove forests around Karachi's harbor, were found tortured and floating in the lagoon the night before, killed by a timber mafia. It's just completely beyond control at the moment. And it's as good an example of any that I know of what President Dwight D. Eisenhower, and that was a pretty conservative president, warned back in 1958 that the biggest threat to global security in the post-war era was going to be overpopulation.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Alan Weissman about his latest book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for Our Future on Earth. It's a very scary example. And this brings us, I guess, back to the question I asked about culture and religion, because one of the greatest barriers in Pakistan is, in fact, religion, barriers to bringing down population. Talk about how that works out there, and then maybe loop back also to Israel and Palestine, because I think that's also a very important example where you have two populations that are set against each other, Orthodox Jews who are driving a very right-wing agenda, and Palestinians who, you know, are both, there's a whole, the demographic bomb that they talk about.
Well, let me start right there, and then I'll move back to the religious issue in Muslim countries that you've raised. You know, I start the book right there because, you know, the Holy Land kind of hits us all in the gut. Most of the people on earth, be they Christian, Jews, or Muslims, you know, consider this to be hallowed ground. And to show that you've got two populations there, each claiming it, and trying to outpopulate each other to be the majority in the land, is incredibly senseless. And yet when we think about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, we never really hear about this. We also don't hear about the related concept that Israel's always been blamed, and correctly so, for holding on to these settlements in the West Bank. Well, there's a reason that just doesn't get explained very often, is that this is a country where there's not an awful lot of fresh water. The major aquifer runs mainly through the West Bank, and you know, those settlements are all on top of wells. That's why they don't want to give them up. Back before the State of Israel was created, it was under British mandate, and British ecologists calculated that the carrying capacity of the land was about 2.5 million people. And the pioneer Zionist who became the first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, argued that Jewish ingenuity could make the desert bloom, and he thought that it could have even more than twice that number. He thought that the land could hold 6 million people. Well, today there are nearly 12 million between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and by mid-century it'll be 21 million, and it's running out of water. Israel has desalinization plants that are running nonstop, and they create more kosher sea salt than you can sell out there on the market, and you can't dump it back into the ocean because it disrupts coastal ecology. So we're really looking at one of the prime examples on the planet of how too much of a good thing is to be really too much. Now, I think that that's more of a political than a religious battle, even though, you know, we famously associate the Holy Land with religion. Because, you know, you go back to Genesis and you see these peoples who are all trying to hold on to wells, and they were fighting each other even back then. There's a great example, though, in my book that was given to me by a Talmudic scholar of one of the ways where culture, in which I found in cultures all over the world, gives us the options, you know, within our religions, without having to tell people your beliefs are wrong, you have to believe somebody else's beliefs to get it right. In the Judeo-Christian Bible in Genesis, you know, first we're having everybody being fruitful and multiply, trying to fill the land. You know, that's a strategy to be the most powerful group around so you don't get usurped by your nations. So for the same reason that Mormons were polygamists many years later, you know, the early Israelites, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were all polygamists trying to have as many children to fill the land. But then we come down to one of Jacob's 13 children, Joseph, who I think may have been history's first recorded ecologist, because he was very observant and he saw that we were entering a time of scarcity. And he had only one wife and two children, and he counseled the Egyptian pharaoh and then the Israelites that this is not a time to keep expanding. This is a time for conserving if they want to save themselves. And I think that this is sort of the situation that we have in the world right now. Every religion has something in it, usually some very prescient words. In the Quran, Muhammad talks about the necessity of the stewardship of the planet and how that is a responsibility of everyone. And I go to several countries that have successfully found ways to take control of their population and to bring it down towards sustainable growth rates, even negative growth rates, because they have grown beyond sustainability. And the most famous example that comes to everybody's mind is China's one-child policy, and nearly nobody likes it, including most of the Chinese. Nobody wants governments telling us what to do in our bedrooms, telling us to control what is basically a natural act, making copies of ourselves. But several countries have come up with ways of persuading people to decide for themselves voluntarily that they're going to be better off having fewer children and their children are going to be better off. And at least three of these countries are Muslim countries. I have a chapter set in the UK and another one in Italy. And, of course, there's widespread fears all over Europe from fear-mongering that has been promoted all over the Internet that all of Europe is going to become a Muslim nation because all these immigrants are proliferating like bunnies and they're going to just take everything over. And, of course, these are wildly inflated claims. The numbers are single-digit percentages of the number of Muslims that we're going to see in the next 50 years in Europe. But nobody really pays attention to the fact, and I have a whole chapter devoted to a very unlikely country, at least in the minds of my fellow Americans here, of a country that has done a beautiful job of bringing its population growth rate down faster than anyone ever in history, including faster than the Chinese, and that's Iran.
Iran, yes. How did they bring, how did that happen? And I mean, Iran is a Muslim theocracy, basically, where women are control to a certain degree, although not as much as I think a lot of people may think in comparison to other Muslim countries. But how did it happen in Iran?
Well, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, before the country barely had a chance to start organizing itself, they were attacked by Iraq. Saddam Hussein had his eye on an oil-rich province on their border, much as he would 10 years later do the same in Kuwait. He invaded, figuring that this was a time when disorganized Iran couldn't defend it. And back then, Saddam Hussein had the backing of NATO. He had sophisticated weaponry from NATO, and he was being provided with the components of nerve gas, which he'd already used against his, you know, his Kurdish minority, and he employed against Iran. Iran just basically had bodies. So the Ayatollah Khomeini asked every Iranian woman who could get pregnant to do so, do a patriotic duty, and help build a 20 million man army to fight off the invaders. And, you know, for 8 years, they held Iraq to a stalemate. Finally, when a truce was brokered, the economist who was planning and budget director for Iran realized that they were going to have a terrible problem within 10, 15 years. These kids were all going to grow up, and they were going to need employment. And he warned the Ayatollah that their economy would be nowhere able to provide jobs for so many people, and that this was going to be a huge destabilizing factor in Iranian society. I mean, he basically was describing Pakistan today. So the Ayatollah agreed to a family planning program, and then before anything could be designed, he died, and the new Ayatollah, who's still in power today, ascended, and they came up with basically a four-point plan. First of all, the Ayatollah issued a fatwa saying that if wisdom dictates that you have the number of children that you can responsibly care for, there's nothing in the Quran against using any kind of contraception, including an operation for a male or a female. Second, they made all of that available. And one of the really smart things the Iranian revolution did, similar to the Cuban Revolution, was win the hearts and mind of a lot of poor people by establishing health clinics throughout the country in the smallest villages. And now, I remember I was in Iran for 2 weeks researching this book, and an OBGYN in Tehran, who I met the first night that I was there, talked to me about being part of these horseback brigades that would go to these remote villages bringing surgical teams and condoms, birth control pills, injections, everything to the people, making it available and making it available for free. But nobody was required to use it. The only requirement was for couples to go to premarital classes before they get married, which frankly isn't a bad idea for anybody. In those classes, among other things, they learn how much does it cost to raise, feed, clothe, and educate a child. And the fourth plank, and this is probably the most significant at all, they encouraged women to stay in school and study. It turns out that everywhere I went, rich country, poor country, female education is the best contraception there is, because a girl tends to postpone her childbearing until she finishes her studies, and then once she's completed them, she has these skills that are, you know, she's prepared to use, they're interesting, they're economically helpful to her family, but it's very hard to exercise them if you've got seven kids hanging on your apron strings. So overwhelmingly throughout the world, the average number of children that an educated woman, by educated I mean high school or beyond, has is two children or fewer. And so, you know, another place that I go in this book is to the Vatican, where I had some very revealing conversations with some cardinals there, but we all know what the Vatican's attitude is towards contraception and birth control. However, it's surrounded by another Catholic country called Italy, which has one of the lowest fertility rates on the planet because it also has the highest percentage of females with graduate degrees, and the two are directly linked. Iran one point during the 20 million man army years, Iran probably reached the biological limits for human growth rate. It was like 4.2%. That's never been seen before on the planet. And then with the new family planning program, they turned it around and came down to replacement rate. That's two people having two children, therefore replacing themselves. They did that a year faster than China's obligatory one-child policy.
We're talking with Alan Weissman about his latest book, Countdown. It's a fascinating story. You also go to Niger, which is a country that is being hugely impacted by climate change, and women are not, it's a place where slavery is endemic and women tend to not have an education. The response to the crisis is to have more kids, not less. And as we look forward, I mean, the world that you describe in Countdown, and I think it's a very realistic picture, is one in which crises are going to be, you know, ever increasing. What's your thought on this? On, you know, as we spiral into increasing disasters, are people going to want more children or less?
Well, you know, you've pinpointed three of the most difficult places on Earth that I do go to in this book. You know, Israel, Palestine, Pakistan, and now Niger. Niger is a Sahel nation. It's the place where the Sahara is encroaching farther and farther, and they have a long tradition of polygamous families for the same reason that, again, everybody on Earth has, every religion has always started with polygamy. To become populous and more powerful than their rivals. Now, when I was in Niger, I talked to women who did tell me, I mean, these horrible stories, village after village, of losing, you know, 150, 200 kids every year to malnutrition. In village after village, I heard that, and I heard two other things. One was that they would say the drought cycle used to be a 10-year cycle, and we could depend on that. We could gauge our plantings, but then it became a 5-year cycle, and then it became a 3-year cycle, and now we're 4 years into the 3-year cycle, and it hasn't ended yet. And also they would say, you know, had you been here 25 years ago, you couldn't have seen that house 100 meters off there because of all the trees we used to have. Well, what happened to the trees? Well, we became, you know, so many of us were cutting them for firewood, and people told me about their cattle dying. And in one of the villages where I was, the question came up. I was at the inauguration of a mayor, and all the men were gathered, and the sultan, regional sultan, was there, and then all the women were on sort of the edges listening in, and they were talking about all these terrible problems that they have. And, you know, the question came up, well, have they tried family planning? And, of course, all the men burst into laughter because they all have three or four wives. The mayor himself has 33 children. And they, you know, they asked me, being from the West, if I had any different perspective on this. And I said, well, you know, family planning might be what you have to do. And they said, but we've always done this. I said, I know. We've all always lived as if there were no limits. And my people were also polygamous before. But you've also described to me how your world has changed. So now we have to make adjustments for a changing world. And the implicit message in that scene, which I make explicit by the end of the book, and it's not really me making these messages. You know, I just go to experts everywhere. I'm just a journalist. But the consensus really unmistakably builds by the end of this book is that one way or another, our population is going to come down. Either we're going to manage it gracefully, and fortunately I show how we do have the means and the momentum to do this, and it's incredibly affordable. It's extremely cheap, actually. Either we're going to bring it down ourselves, or nature's going to do it for us, because nature always knocks back the population of any species that is living beyond its means. The Green Revolution, we thought, stretched our means, but now we're seeing the downside of all that. The use of nitrogen fertilizer is poisoning enormous percentages of our waterways. They're running out of water for the Green Revolution in India. I mean, at one point, I traveled around interviewing widows of Green Revolution farmers who've committed suicide because their original wells, which were 50 feet deep, now go down 500 or 1,000 feet deep because the water table's dropping and they can't afford it. And it's a staggering figure, which I verified with the Indian government that their farm union gave me. Since 1995, 270,000 Green Revolution farmers in India have committed suicide. They do it symbolically by drinking pesticide because they can no longer keep the Green Revolution going. So we're reaching our limits. The atmosphere and changing climate is showing us that we're reaching our limits. And these people in Niger are starting to realize that maybe this is time that we have to change. And that goes for everybody on Earth, rich or poor.
Alan Weissman. We'll continue our conversation about overpopulation and what to do about it after the break. Weissman's book is Countdown. Stick around.
And who has time to ask the Earth's permission? I fly all across the country. I'm into making music for environmental causes. I'm a sucker. But every time I start my jet, it lets off more emissions. And who has time to ask the Earth's permission?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Alan Weissman about his terrific book, Countdown. It's about overpopulation and what we can do about it. In every chapter, you talk about things that are being done, even in a place like Niger, where people are trying to adapt. But a lot of people in the West are really looking towards a technological fix. I remember going to the Clinton Global Initiative in New York a couple of years ago, and there was an awful lot of talk by people like Monsanto and others about a new green revolution with GMOs, with genetically engineered organisms. You know, we were going to have to feed, 10 billion people by 2050 or 9 billion people by 2050, and Monsanto was going to ride to the rescue.
Well, you know, when I went to the Vatican, I asked how it was that a pope, at the time it was Benedict XVI, who really understood a lot about the environment, he was better than most politicians in the world about it, still, though, was preaching that there was enough for everyone on the planet. There would be enough food for everyone on the planet if we just shared equitably. And you may hear that a lot. Progressives say that a lot. And my response to the Pope and also those progressives, I said, when we're talking about feeding everyone, are we just talking about Homo sapiens, or are we talking about the other species? Because a large part of this book is discussing how much nature do we have to preserve in order to ensure our own survival. I mean, ever since the biblical story of Noah, which also appears in the Quran, God made it very clear that to save mankind, you also have to save all the animals. We can't have a world without them. The Vatican, their environmental policy people admitted to me that they really hadn't asked that question. But in terms of feeding humans, it was exactly what you were talking about. They pointed to the Green Revolution centers as right now developing new transgenic plants that would be able to increase technologically our food supply even more. So I went to those centers. It's the wheat and corn center in Mexico and the rice center in the Philippines. And in both places, everyone first of all told me that the idea that the Green Revolution had refuted Malthus and the Ehrlichs was completely incorrect. the founder of the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, who in his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, and he's credited with saving more human lives than anyone in human history, in that speech he did not gloat. He said, "We have just bought a generation of time. Unless increased food production and population control join hand in hand, we are going to lose this battle." And at the Green Revolution Centers, they showed me what the transgenic experiments are. They're trying to hot rod photosynthesis to try to kick it up 50% to yield even more grain and possibly even to give plants enough energy to fix their own nitrogen to minimize the amount of nitrogen fertilizer. However, they said, even if we can do this, and we don't know if we can, commercialization of it is 25, 30 years off. And by then, there's going to be 2.5 billion more people. They said, you know, at these rates, we're going to have to produce more food in the next 50 years than has been consumed in all of human history. And they thanked me in both places for being there to talk about population, because they say it's the one thing that they can't possibly control.
You also, and we've spoken about it, we've touched on it here, but you really make a very close link between climate change and overpopulation. I mean, I think a lot of people think, okay, overpopulation is going to increase climate change, but climate change is limiting the environment that we have to survive in.
Well, of course it is. One of the aspects of our food production that's linked to climate is that scientists widely are in agreement that for every 1 degree centigrade of average temperature increase, grain production is going to drop 10%. We're already seeing corn harvests failing all over the world when we're having these extreme temperature spikes that we've never seen before for such, you know, in such frequency and in so prolonged. So, yeah, I frequently am asked, but is it really overpopulation? Isn't it really just overconsumption, including overconsumption of energy that's causing all these problems, you know, consumption of goods and using so many fossil fuels, etc.? And don't we just have to change that? Well, you know, yeah, except how. I've never met anybody who's been able to tell me how we're going to limit consumption. Paul Ehrlich, who I interviewed several times for this book, knows that there just isn't a condom out there for consumption. And as for fossil fuels, I mean, look, we know that renewables can produce energy for us, but these are not totally mature technologies. We don't know how to make the wind blow all the time, and we don't have sunlight at night, and our storage capacity for those energies, at the times when they're not being driven, are really minimal. The uptake for getting rid of fossil fuels in the planet, I mean, it's painfully obvious that we're still squeezing tar sands and talking about a total oxymoron, clean coal. We're shattering the bedrock of this continent to try to get natural gas to bubble to the surface. I don't see us limiting fossil fuels. You and I are talking to each other right now through the benefit of electricity. We're all addicted to electricity. Imagine cutting it out of your life. So one of the reasons that I wrote this book is that the one thing that I know that would impact the amount of carbon dioxide that we're sending up our chimneys and out our exhaust pipes right now would be to limit the number of consumers for these fossil fuels. I'm not saying that we shouldn't keep trying to perfect renewable energy, but we have to do everything now. And within two generations, if everyone now started having two children or fewer, we could significantly bring our population back down to sustainable size. And as I mentioned earlier, the cost is really minimal compared to the cost of our global economy. To make contraception available worldwide for anyone who chose to use it, and by the way, in the book I do talk about the new male contraceptives that are coming online, to do that would cost about $8.1 billion per year, which is less than your country and mine was spending per month throughout most of the last decade in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, this is eminently affordable.
Right. I do want to say I think some of those storage technologies are happening for renewables, part of the problem has been the lack of political will to scale, you know, to put a lot into research and development and scale them up. But in any case, any kind of wide adoption of a new technology takes decades. And your point here is that we could begin to see a result almost immediately if we instituted this.
Exactly. This is technology we already have. It doesn't require any leaps, and it doesn't require any, you know, astonishing new political will. The United States is by far the best provider and biggest provider of contraception worldwide through USAID. I've written critically about USAID in the past for the way, you know, we've tried to influence other countries, but I have to say that I'm proud that my tax dollars go to this. And I'm proud that USAID has kept those programs going, even during some more conservative presidencies, where presidents have tried to cut back on the amount of family planning that the United States provides. I've met some very brave people at USAID who have kept it going. There are also, you know, there are four major foundations in the world, and they're all based in the United States, that are major funders for this. On the other hand, I'm not a member of a political party, but if President Obama's opponents would have won that last presidential election, I mean, Romney and Ryan were very clear that this was funding that they wanted to cut severely. And if they did, I mean, right now, we're headed to a pretty sobering figure. We're going to be $9.5 billion by the middle of the century, $11 billion by the end of it. And that's assuming that contraception levels remain constant right now. But the supply lines are very fragile. Again, a presidential election could really, really change things. Or, crash in a stock market and the endowment fund of a foundation goes through the floor. Just a half a child more per woman in the world, if contraception is not available at today's level, means that we'd be headed to 16 billion people by the end of the century. But a half a child fewer would take us back to 6 billion, and that would be bringing us back in the direction of a much more sustainable population. And by the way, we probably don't have time to get into it, but a good part of this book is devoted to how can we design an economy that will prosper for a shrinking and then stable population. I mean, just, you know, economy whose health is not determined by constant growth. I mean, you can't have constant growth on a planet that doesn't keep growing. You know, even Adam Smith recognized that, yet you still hear this.
We're talking with Alan Weissman. His book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for Our Future on Earth. Before you go into that economy, I want our listeners to hear about that. Tell us what would be a sustainable human population on this planet.
Well, you know, it's been calculated a couple of different ways that I refer to in this book. Let's start with one that I mentioned earlier: nitrogen fertilizer. Nitrogen fertilizer has had such an enormous impact on us that, think of it this way, 40% of us could not be on this planet without it. That's how much extra plant life it has allowed to flourish. Well, except, is it really flourishing? Because we see tremendous downside of nitrogen fertilizer. I mean, at one point, I go to a farm in Mexico that was one of the early recipients of nitrogen fertilizer and Green Revolution technology, and now four-fifths of it, because they produce so much food there, four-fifths of it is too sterile to produce anything. And they've had to cut way back, and they're growing stuff organically now in greenhouses there. This stuff fouls downstream waters, both in rivers And once it reaches the ocean, it leaves chunks of the ocean the size of New Jersey dead at the mouths of the world's great rivers. You know, when the Aswan Dam was built in Egypt, and suddenly there weren't those annual floods that would replenish the silts in the Nile Valley, they had to start using artificial fertilizer, and within 5 years, the fish catch in the Mediterranean was cut by 50%.
Yeah.
So we can't keep doing this. Plus, nitrogen fertilizer is derived from fossil fuels. It takes fossil fuels to fabricate it. And then when it degrades, you get nitrous oxide, which after methane is our third most potent greenhouse gas. So if we cut that out, by cutting it out, I don't mean tomorrow, but we phase out of it gradually over the next couple of two, three decades or so, we would be accompanying that with managed population growth, meaning that people would be encouraged to have just two children or fewer and would have the opportunity, you know, the contraceptives to make that decision. If they wanted to have big families, you know, one resource that we're never running out of is children who need a home, so people can adopt and have as many children as they want. You know, that certainly solved one of the huge problems of the Chinese one-child policy when China was still mostly rural population. They were favoring male births because you wanted those strong young farmhands and girl babies. You know, there was tremendous gender discrimination and selective abortion. But today, you know, adoption leapt in, and we see all over the United States and Europe and Canada and Australia this beautiful, sprinkling of Chinese girls in our current generation of youth. And internal adoption in China is now way up, too. So there are ways to get around what we might perceive initially to be problems. This is something that we actually can do, and there's great momentum in the world for it right now. Nearly half the countries in the world are either at, near, or below replacement rate. Everywhere I went, you make contraception available, and women want to use it. You combine that with female education, and, I mean, this is a no-brainer. You know, I talked about the hopelessness of Pakistan, but one of the most hopeful stories in this book is in Pakistan, where five Pakistani businessmen having dinner one night and just complaining about what a wreck their nation was, finally decided to do something about it themselves. And the schools were so dysfunctional, they decided to start their own school system. It's a private school system, but it costs next to nothing. And they built schools in the poorest parts of rural and urban Pakistan. They insist that these schools be co-educational. 50% girls, they want boys and girls growing up alongside each other so the boys can learn to respect them. They have all female teachers so people aren't scared about sending their daughters to school. And they don't talk about family planning in these because oftentimes they're very, very conservative populations there. But when the kids get into secondary school, they ask them what professions they might be interested in, and they pair them with mentors, professional mentors in these professions. So girls are, you know, doctors, nurses, flight attendants, school teachers. And what the girls see is that all of these role models have two children or fewer because otherwise they can't have their jobs. And that's how the message gets out. And I asked these guys, I said, but, you know, what about the Taliban? Because they have vowed to blow up all these schools if they're teaching girls. And they said, we made it clear to the Taliban from the very start. We promised them for every school of ours that they blow up, we would start five more. And today, they have over 900 schools in Pakistan, and this is still growing. It's doubled since I was there 3 years ago. So, you know, just think of the benefit. You know, think of the extra, you know, brilliance that we're going to have in our labor force with all these prepared girls. You know, a lot of economists say, what are we going to do, you know, if we have fewer babies being born and all these senior citizens that they have to support through the welfare rolls. And
yeah, so get into that. Tell us about the economy based on, I think you say that the optimal population is about 2 billion, so we got a ways to go.
Yeah, well, that's what about the population was before we started using nitrogen fertilizer. There's another calculation in the book about optimum population that was done by John Holdren, who is now President Obama's science advisor. And he was just looking at carbon, projected carbon use, and he was looking at this about 15 years ago in the 1990s, but his predictions were remarkably prescient, of course, and trying to determine how much carbon dioxide quotas could we have per capita in the world if everybody had a fairly reasonable lifestyle, say a European lifestyle, not as profligate as the American lifestyle, and certainly one that Africans or South Asians might aspire to. And that figure divided out came out to be between 1.5 and 2 to 3 billion people maximum. Look, having many fewer children reduces the carbon legacy of any woman more so than anything else that she can do, the number of Priuses she's driving or compact fluorescent bulbs or whatever. There's a calculation in the book of the tens of tons of carbon dioxide that each child represents. Now, in terms of the economy, just a couple of things about what we hear from traditional economists about the fear-mongering of, oh, we're going to have way too many old people and not enough young people, and that's why there's been a spate of books that came out not long before my book came out about why there were in danger of population crashes in the developed countries. A couple of things about that. First of all, pro-growth economists love big populations because it keeps labor cheap. They want a lot of poor people fighting each other over bad salaries, and they want to keep suppressing those wages. When we start bringing population down, workers will be fewer, and therefore they're going to be more valued, and wages will actually remain high. Second, the idea that we're going to have this bubble of all these senior citizens that we're going to have to take care of with just fewer workers, as opposed to what we have today, where children are much more of an economic burden on society than seniors. For one, because our health is better, seniors are still largely economically productive after they're 65. Some of them pushing 80. Second, kids, unless they're farmhands, of which many fewer of us live on farms now, they cost society money. They don't really contribute very much in terms of earning power, and we need to maintain schools for them, etc. So the idea that we cannot transition gradually over the next few decades to a much more sustainable size is really, it's belied in my book by the chapter that I set in Japan where we talk about the economy, because Japan now has an economy, or it has a population that is actually shrinking for a couple of anomalous reasons, but it is really the pioneer nation in this. Japan's population is shrinking because after World War II, its economy was wrecked, and they started having a baby boom for the same reason that we had ours. Our soldiers went back home to their wives. But then they were starving there. So in an emergency measure in 1949, they legalized abortion. Remember, this was before birth control pills, because pregnant Japanese women were throwing themselves in front of trains. Women did not want to see any more babies die of hunger. So millions of them partook of the abortions, and now as a last overgrown generation that was born before World War II. You might remember Japan started World War II because they had an overpopulation problem, so they were trying to expand into Manchuria. Anyhow, as that generation now begins to pass on, there's a much smaller baby boom generation to replace them. and they in turn have many fewer babies. And with the high education levels, most Japanese women who live in crowded cities are only having one kid, some two and some none. And of course, traditional economists are terrified by this, but I traveled to see a very visionary economist named Akihiko Matsutani, who's not a radical, he's part of a major policy institute, but he sees this as opportunity. Japan is going to have to learn within its to live more within in its means. And that was really underscored by the fact that not long before I got there, Fukushima took care of all their nuclear power. And Japan has to discover, it also lost its most fertile fruit-bearing region, too, in that disaster. So the fact that their population now is starting to drop dramatically, and by the middle of this century, they're going to be much closer towards their World War II population than today's, which is over 100 million. What he sees is going to happen is that, as I follow in this book, I follow young people who are now moving into the hinterlands because older people no longer live in these farming villages and there's land available and housing available for cheap. He says lighter industry will follow them. You don't need to have everybody in these crowded port cities so they can import all these raw materials for export, heavy industries. They'll have lighter industries for more domestic use. Wages will remain high because workers will be fewer, but because demand will shrink with population, working hours will diminish. And that means that we're going to redefine prosperity as having more leisure time to enjoy more space that we'll also have. And this is really a workable idea for a future. And it's not going to be totally easy, but he said over the next few decades, as population comes down, economy will be able to adjust to a stable rate. And, as Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill before him, all predicted, we're not going to be having these huge violent swings in sudden profits and sudden losses in stock markets. We'll be more in sort of a perpetual bond market situation where people will be living off more secure investments. And this is something that conservatives will really like. The only reason that we have such enormous debt and deficits now is that we're constantly borrowing money into existence. Debt is what creates our money supply in an ever-expanding economy, which occasionally just collapses on us because it expands beyond reality, like the housing crisis. As we shrink down to a stable situation, to a steady-state economy, we'll be back on a cash basis. That means a balanced budget. Now, what conservative is going to argue with that?
Well, it's a great vision and one that I very desperately hope will actually come to pass because the alternative is just so terrifying. Alan Weissman, this is just a terrific book. I think it should be required reading for everybody. Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure, Francesca.
Alan Weissman's book is Countdown. You can read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. You'll also find a link there to our last interview with Alan Weissman about his book, The World Without Us. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.